In 1975, Jaws was released. It is routinely regarded as one of the greatest films of all time and is generally credited with creating the concept of the summer blockbuster. In 1978, in an obvious cash grab, Jaws 2 was released, failing to have lightning strike a second time, but presenting a generally enjoyable film. In 1983, Jaws 3D was released, shamelessly attempting to take advantage of a gullible audience. By 1987, there was no pretense of quality as Lorraine Gary and Michael Caine cashed paychecks for sleepwalking through a pointless and incredulous sequel. In 2016, Paul Spitero created Is It Jaws, in which he and a group of rotating guest hosts discuss new and old movies and place them up against the Jaws scale, which ignores some elements of the actual films and sets forth a rating scale. Jaws, an all-time great classic film. Jaws 2, an enjoyable film with some flaws but worthy of multiple viewings. Jaws 3, a moderately enjoyable film. And finally, Jaws 4, a bad movie. Please join Paul and his guests as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
How do you do? I'm Alfred Hitchcock, and I would like to tell you about my latest motion picture, Marnie, which will be coming to this theater soon. Marnie is a very difficult picture to classify. It is not Psycho, nor do we have a horde of birds flapping about and pecking at people willy-nilly. We do have two very interesting human specimens, a man and a woman. One might call Marnie a sex mystery, that is, if one used such words. But it is more than that. Perhaps the best way to tell you about the picture is to show you a few scenes. This is Mark coming down the stairs of his family home outside Philadelphia. He is a thoughtful man, dark and brooding. He is, in a sense, a hunter. And this is what he is hunting. Marnie. Seeing her in her mother's modest house, one wonders how two such different people could cross paths. It was certainly not Marnie's idea. Marnie was going about her own business like any normal girl. Happy, happy, happy. Suddenly into this colorful life comes Mark. At first he didn't know what to make of Marnie. She does seem a rather excitable type. What would account for this strange behavior? Has she just realized that she forgot her umbrella?
The colors! Stop the colors!
What colors?
Marnie's trouble goes deeper than that. Far deeper. And this is the problem which Mark must probe. But first, something must be done to calm this girl. Our hero applies mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. But that may give you the impression this picture is all sex and no mystery. Not so at all. Here, for example, Marnie is speaking to, I'm not sure who, actually, but he is a man from her past, a past she seems to be denying. Oh dear, they're at it again. Let me assure you that this is all in the spirit of investigation. And this, here is further proof that Marnie is a talking picture.
You don't love me. I'm just something you've caught. You think I'm some kind of animal you've trapped.
That's right, you are. And I've caught something really wild this time, haven't I? I've tracked you and caught you, and by God, I'm going to keep you.
That should be quite enough. If you wish to hear more, you will have to buy a ticket. As for which one of them is the wild animal, there are times when I'm not sure. I don't think that was necessary. Actually, I think I should withhold comment, since I'm not certain I understand this scene. I shall leave the explanation to your own vivid imagination. It would appear that Mark has a single solution for all problems. This is not so. Mark is a complex man, dark and forbidding. He can also be kind and considerate. And he is also a troubled man. Troubled because he cannot seem to unravel the mystery of the girl called Marnie.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Yours? I'm Paul Spataro, and I am joined, as ever, by Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is a pleasure to be here.
It is a pleasure to have you here. And we are continuing in our Alfred Hitchcock retrospective, for lack of a better word. So we have Mr. Blaine Dowler and Mr. Trey Hooks with us. Good evening, gentlemen.
Hello.
It is not evening. It is very early in the morning, and it is especially early in the morning where Blaine is.
It's only 5:38 a.m.
Depths
of winter. Current temperature is 7 degrees colder than Antarctica at the moment, but that's okay.
I hope you have a good heating system. But, You know, when we do Alfred Hitchcock, I just always feel tempted to say good evening to start things off. But we are looking today at the 1964 movie, Marnie. Now, this is, a fairly well-known movie. You know, people are familiar with it. They know there was a Sean Connery, Alfred Hitchcock movie. You know, the name is known. But I think this one is not as, well, it's certainly not as widely popular as, you know, a lot of the big name ones and the ones of this era. And it's one I had not seen, and that was why I had put it out there as the movie for us to do this time. So I watched it for this, and then I rewatched it for this, and then I watched a little pieces here and there again. So I have like 2.5 viewings of this movie. And I have to say, I'll give you my first impression, and then I'll pass it on to you guys. I was under the impression that the acting was very good. The actual cinematography was beautiful. The directing was not exceptional Hitchcock, but kind of typical Hitchcock. And the story was not good. I did not like the story, and that really affected the overall, you know, opinion on the movie. I thought there was a lot of it where it came off as pop psychology, I'm going to call it. You know, just we're going to throw something out there and we're going to pretend that this is real. And it's based on, you know, theories that just don't seem to hold any water as far as I'm concerned. So that really affected my ability to watch it. And that and the fact that our leading man, despite the fact that he's incredibly charismatic, was kind of a douche.
The only thing I would do there in response to that sentence is delete the words kind of. Possibly use a stronger word than douche.
So I'm going to throw it out to you guys now and get your first impressions, and then we'll get more deeply into it. So anybody, whoever wants to jump in now.
I'm of a similar mind, Paul. You know, the film's about someone who experiences trauma, and you know, yes, trauma can definitely impact you, but this kind of feels like somebody read like a New Yorker article of like psychological symptoms and decided to give one character like all of them. And I don't know. This Vertigo kind of teeters on a balance for me, but manages not to fall off the rails. This one kind of fell off the rails. The blend of the pop psychology and kind of Hitchcock's particular types of kink just didn't work in this film for me.
I think story is pretty critical for me in this one too. Paul, I agree with everything Paul was saying about the positives, you know, as far as there's some solid acting in this and thing, you know, I mean, people were working with a script that kind of gave them the opportunity to do these performances that I what I found myself saying is probably the simplest way to say it. I liked the movie until I didn't. And there came a point in time where I was like, oh, this is just uncomfortable. and I was left with that. I watched it twice, and I deliberately watched it a second time because sometimes you have that initial viewing where there's the emotion of this is new to me because this is the first time I've seen it too. So I'm in the camp of I had not seen it before then. It had all of the building blocks of everything I should have loved. It was a Hitchcock movie, great cast. I'm a big Sean Connery fan. He felt like Bond in the beginning, which was like it's sort of in the start. And I'm kind of like, okay, likable. And it had Alfred from Batman 66. So I should have like loved everything about this until the point where I didn't. I also watched it with my wife, and it's the first one for this show that like I haven't seen, my wife hasn't seen, and she wanted to watch it first viewing. So I'm like, oh, this will be great. We'll sit down like together and really enjoy this. Until we didn't. Which I'm tipping my hat a little bit on this one, but it's a complicated journey, and I think this is going to be an interesting discussion because of that. Because there's some interesting, I think, conflicting elements in this that are going to be fun to talk about.
Yeah, I'm also struggling with this one. I saw it for the first time about 10 or 15 years ago. I was already trying to watch all the Hitchcocks, and I had a colleague who was named after this movie.
Oh, wow.
So She was Marnie, and was like, okay. You know, so I went to check out this thing for, you know, why someone loved this particular Hitchcock so much to name a child after it. Mm-hmm. And my main struggle with this is that the only truly sympathetic character in this whole thing is the horse.
That is so true.
But the horse is 100% victim. Everybody else, there's some comeuppance and finding out more about the background. In the original novel, one of the conditions of the marriage was that Marnie see a psychologist regularly, or a psychiatrist on the regular basis. And that was in there. The husband was not a psychiatrist. The husband was a fetishist who wanted to be with a thief, and it didn't particularly matter which thief.
Mm.
And Hitchcock says that didn't quite come across on screen.
No.
No, and that's part of the issue.
I didn't read the novel. I've never, you know, my exposure is purely just seeing the movie. But based on the way the character is in this movie, if it was similar in the book, I would think he would have her see a psychologist or psychiatrist who is on his payroll and reporting to him, despite the ethical problems with that. And, you know, that he would be using that more to manipulate her. And again, that's the way I see this character. I just see him as a control freak who, you know, it's weird because there's a chemistry between the two characters, between the two actors, mm-hmm. but it just doesn't ring true based on the story. I think the acting is top notch in this movie. You know, this is only Tippi Hedren's second movie after The Birds. Mm-hmm. And I think she does a great job with it. And Sean Connery is Sean Connery. I think people didn't realize what a great actor Sean Connery was until, you know, the late 70s, early 80s. But he was consistent through his whole career. It wasn't that he learned to be a great actor. He was the whole time. But because he did James Bond, I think people tended to just dismiss his acting ability. You know, to your point, I just think that this whole psychiatrist angle could have been an interesting aspect of the movie if we are wanting to portray him as a control freak.
Well, it would have helped to explain, beyond the fact that she's beautiful, his obsession with Marnie. You know, I mentioned Vertigo earlier, and what helps me get through Vertigo is I can understand someone being obsessed with a lookalike of someone that, you know, someone was strongly attracted to or in love with. And I think Hitchcock probably made the right call. I don't think anybody would really, you know, understand, ooh, I'm attracted to thieves. but he doesn't replace it with anything.
Yeah, I think a big part of I think a big part of the issue with this is that it's not a love story, it's a lust story.
Yeah.
There is no solid substance in this relationship.
Yeah, which is weird, because like I said, there is, or at least I sensed the chemistry between the actors, and then to have the story betray that chemistry, so that it's I don't even know if lust story, it's more complex than that, because I think he's got a combination of lust and control freak, because he's trying to, it's like he's trying to own her. He's trying to to take her and fix her and turn her into what he wants her to be. You know, and basically, I think that's to a large extent just the, you know, the trophy bride. I don't even know that there's, you know, there's any caring, you know, I don't think his desire to fix her has anything to do with caring about her and wanting her to live a better life. You know, and it's funny because he doesn't come off as that immediately. Just the more the movie goes on, the more that is apparent. And I think we should probably talk about the elephant in the room, you know, in a moment. But I think Sean has a point to make.
Just more building off of this, what the relationship was like early on, because it actually was what was drawing me into the film in the beginning. When he meets her, you almost immediately recognize between the two different, like she jumps from one life to the other, right? And we see that. He's encountered her at both. So we got to have an idea of the fact that he knew, you know, I mean, that was something they didn't blast at you, but it was the portrayal, the acting. It's where it was like, I'm like, okay, there's some good, this is intriguing to me. She's beautiful, which is something that, like, there's something intriguing about her, which you get the kind of sexy aspect of the fact that there's a danger to her, but there's also something, you know, intriguing about her. You get the building blocks of, like, why in the beginning. Then it seems to take a drastic turn to the point where they start to become like nobody's likable. And that's part of the problem I have. The dad, his dad was somebody who, if you were to ask me, besides the horse, his dad, who makes these like cameo appearances over there, I'm like, okay, he's kind of likable, but he's also living in this environment. How does he not see this disaster?
Well, in the one, so before we get to the elephant in the room, I've got a couple of things that I want to build off of on what you just said, Sean. One is, I agree 100% with you, Paul. I love Tippi Hedren's performance in this. So what I'm going to say is not like a problem with her acting, but I think the character as written is inconsistent. And again, yes, people can be complex and have layers, but like for the first third of the film, she's the femme fatale who, you know, preys on men, and then you kind of think this is going in the, you know, she met the one man who was her match, and it could almost be in rom-com territory, and then it's like he takes her to meet his family, kind of as you said, Sean, and then everything turns, and it stops becoming, you know, I'm no good for you to be, I don't want to be with you, I don't want to be here, and it seems like that flips on a dime.
Yes.
And then, you know, the horrible sister-in-law who clearly lust after Sean Connery does nobody any favors.
Yeah, if at least Lil had been, you know, if her machinations to try and break up this relationship had not been selfish because she wants to be with the guy and had been because she sees this is a broken woman who can't have a healthy relationship. Stop doing this to her. Mm-hmm. Right. If that was her motivation, it would have been a better film. But again, Lil is out for herself, and that's it. Right. Sean Connery's character, Mr. Rutland, I think, Sean said, he's not looking for an independent wife. He's looking for an automaton. And you talk about him fixing her. I never got the impression that he wanted to fix anything more than her inability to handle the human touch, which is, mm-hmm. Skirting closer to that elephant. Right.
I think we're hitting on something that I hadn't really thought about is that, when we talk about the weaknesses in the story, I wasn't sure exactly what it was, but I think the weakness is character motivation. I think each character's motivation in this movie, as far as the story goes, is more a reflection of where they want the story to go than it is true to the character. So it keeps the characters from feeling truly three-dimensional, despite the fact that the actors are doing their damnedest to give them, some depth and give them some, make it appear real. But everybody just seems to be doing what they're doing so that we can get to that final confrontation with Marty's mother.
It's almost like scenes are missing, like pivotal scenes of transition between like, I'm this person and now I'm this person. Like even Lil is like, the foil throughout the movie where it's like she's getting in the way of their relationship because of her motivations. And I actually was like intrigued by that. Like, okay, where is this going to go? Then when the horse sequence happens, she shows like these signs of compassion where she's willing to like, here, let me do it. Let me take care of this. Let me be the one. And it's almost out of nowhere. Like she is the like evil person behind the scenes who's trying to cause problems for the reasons that we were stating. And then she's like willing to help, like, let me take care of the gutter. Let me get one of the men or something like that. And it almost seemed out of nowhere from her to be nice to Marnie, it's just an intriguing, jarring transition that like happened. And it was almost like I was having trouble getting to know the characters, because of that. I felt that way with Marnie and his relationship too. We got to go to the elephant in the room as well.
All right. Well, we have kind of a double. There's kind of two elephants in the room, to be honest with you, because one is real life and one is on film.
Yeah. And there's, remind me at some point, I want to come back to that because the scene's missing.
Well, why don't we get to that? The elephant is going to stay there. You can hit on the scenes that are missing first.
By the time they finished discussing this film, Hitchcock and Truffaut agreed to tell the story right. The film should have been 3 hours. And what we got, I think, was about 2 hours and 10 minutes, if memory serves.
Were there any scenes that were either excised or filmed and not put in there, or anything that you know of from reading the Truffaut book that that could have made it better?
It sounds like this film is a faithful representation of the script. And before we go much further, I will agree with kind of what we've already said. There is no set of actors and production team, I think, that could make this significantly better starting from this script.
Yeah. Yeah. I heard somebody say once, this would have been a better movie if it was Cary Grant and Grace Kelly. And I say, no, it wouldn't have been. I don't think the acting would have been any better at all. I think the acting would have been on a par, but I don't, and the charisma would have been on a par, but I don't see anything that was done in the performances that would bring up the script to the point where you say, I don't care. The performances are so masterful, or the actors are so masterful that it gets me beyond that script. So,
go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. I don't know about that either, because it's, well, the role that went to Tippi Hedren was offered to Grace Kelly first. She was already Princess of Monaco. This was going to be her return to acting, but word got out about it, and the citizens of Monaco said, we don't want our princess playing a thief. So she backed out.
And good for the citizens of Monaco, because this would not have been a shining star in Grace Kelly's acting career anyway.
Yeah, and then beyond that, again, on our approach to the elephant, or at least one of the elephants, I think Sean Connery is much more believable in this type of role than Cary Grant is.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably that could be correct. Do we want to talk about the real elephant or the cinematic elephant?
Oh, I don't know. It's the which of the real elephants? Because
the real elephant. Okay, so we'll go to that. The real elephant is Tippi Hedren has had a book out within the last few years, where she says that Hitchcock sexually made sexual advances. I don't believe there was ever any actual physical abuse that she underwent, but she definitely underwent psychological abuse. And when she rejected him, he basically said he's going to ruin her career. And apparently he did everything he could to do that. I heard an interview with Tippi Hedren at one point where she was saying, when this book was recently released, and she had said she had developed a friendship with Hitchcock's wife, who was fully aware of what was going on, and she was like, well, why aren't you doing anything about this? And apparently the wife was just kind of like, just let it go, it doesn't matter. So I guess she and Hitch had that kind of relationship where, he could do what he wanted when he wasn't with her. But just the thought that, I've always heard that Hitchcock was kind of a control freak in the filming, but I always took that to mean from a work perspective. So I find it extremely distasteful to have an artist out there who I enjoy his work so much, and then find out that behind the scenes he was, to use a word that we can use on the show, he was an ass, and he was, a horrible ass. And that really bothers me, because it's, look at what that's done to Roman Polanski's reputation over the years. Oh. And this is not entirely different. It's different factually, but it's not different as far as what it means to that particular artist, as far as I'm concerned.
But this is going on and she's filming this story.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oof. Mm.
And then the interesting talk was, I don't remember the name of the film, but she was in a film after this one that was directed by Charlie Chaplin. I can't recall the name of it. And that was where they said it was ironic, as Hitchcock's trying to end her career, and she gets a call the next day from Charlie Chaplin asking her to be in a movie that he's directing. And she was like, he was so different from Hitchcock. Was Hitchcock had everything down to the storyboards, really what was most important to him. And Chaplin would get up and he'd perform the scene for them and then say, now you do it your way. so different, to work with him, and that he was so wonderful to work with. But I can see after The Birds and after this, where she would be a tremendously on the rise, and you would think she'd be doing a lot more commercially popular type movies that she really didn't do. So I don't doubt for a second that Hitchcock put a large weight to damper her career.
It's a shame.
Yeah. Had either the Me Too movement hit sooner or Hitchcock survived to be a part of it. Sorry, I seem to be getting dropouts on my internet connection here. But yeah, had the Me Too movement hit sooner or Hitchcock survived to be a part of it, his career would have been justifiably ended.
Yeah, I think he would have a similar public persona. If we moved his career up 40 years or 30 years, whatever it would be, I think he would be looked at similarly to the way like Kevin Spacey is looked at right now.
Yeah, I think, from my understanding, that probably the best comparison rather than Spacey or Polanski would be Weinstein.
That's even worse.
Well, it's his motivation is you perform these acts forward to me, or I will end your career. And that was Weinstein's approach. And when Weinstein did it, I'm blanking on the name of the actress. She was not Lisa Kudrow, but the other one in Romeo and Michelle's High School Reunion. She was in Mimic, right? She had
Oscar nominations.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, she was the one who, when she turned Weinstein down, he spread the word that she was incredibly difficult to work with and not worth hiring, which pretty much ended her career.
There was also, what was the other actress? Mm. Annabelle Sciorra, something like that. She also had a huge career drop as a result of things that occurred.
Yeah, I mean, Hitchcock and Weinstein had similar approaches. Hitchcock targeted maybe two or three women as opposed to Weinstein's several dozen. But so the scale is very different, but the methodology is comparable. And that's part of it. But honestly, this movie is one of the reasons that it didn't surprise me when I learned this about Hitchcock, because of the way his quote unquote hero treats the girl.
Art imitates life, because that's honestly, as you were talking, Blaine, I was like sitting there thinking to myself, I'm like, boy, this is where the movie fell apart for me. Because I was actually enjoying the journey of these two characters. I was seeing him fall in love with her. You know, we mentioned lust earlier, and couldn't agree more with that thought process as far as what was the original draw between the two, because I felt that, and they created a chemistry, which says a lot about the acting talent, in the sense that I felt like that chemistry between these two characters. So recasting it, I was totally nodding along when everyone was saying, recasting it wouldn't have fixed this. Because I felt like the casting was fine. It's the certain point in time where I'm like, this isn't the same guy. Or if it is, boy, he's a monster. Like, it's...
Well, he becomes irredeemable.
Yes, yes, exactly right. And I felt like he was hurting her more than helping her. And that's a real, like, rough place to be in at the end of the film, where I'm like, I don't think she's going off to a good life at all. Like, how is this better than the horror that she was raised with? And that's a really uncomfortable place to be left in the film. And that's, boys, you're like sitting here like, oh, this is what's going on behind the scenes. I'm like, oh, ew. And we watched it play out to a certain extent.
So I'm gonna just say, as far as that first elephant in the room that we've discussed now, I think the four of us have a mutual disgust for the fact that that occurred. And it has tainted our view of Hitchcock on a personal level. But I think from this point, moving forward, barring any other revelations about things that he did behind the scenes on specific movies that we might be discussing, I'd rather discuss Hitchcock's output as opposed to his personality.
Sure.
So, you know, that doesn't mean that we're not disgusted by it, but, you know, we're also not putting any money into this dead man's pocket by doing these reviews either. So it's not like, you know, sweeping it under the carpet is causing anybody any pain that I'm aware of. So now we can move on to the cinematic elephant.
Well, film's also a body of work that encompasses a lot of. So at the end of the day, when you're studying a series of films and things like that, you're not just studying one person. You're really, I mean, we're looking at all the actors, the production team, and things like that that go behind the scenes of this. So there's a lot to discuss in this film.
There is. I mean, the other real-life elephant in the room, this came out in 1964, and 1965 was the year that Sean Connery did his Playboy interview when he talked about when and how it's appropriate to beat your wife. So, which is why I'm saying I find it much easier to see Sean Connery in this role than Cary Grant, because I'm thinking, like, when Paul started this saying what we're seeing is Sean Connery, and he is Sean Connery, I'm going, yeah, you might be more ripe than any of us wanted to admit. Now, the big elephant, and cinematic elephant in the room that we'll let Paul get into in a moment, is that he goes far beyond beating. He threatens to beat, but that's that's not okay. What happens is so much worse.
You know, Sean, you weren't in on this, but Blaine and Trey and I discussed Gone with the Wind, which had a similar thing to discuss in it in its own way, and we kind of went through it. And, you know, there was this thought process that seemed to be cinematic. I hope it wasn't too much in the real world, but it's different now than it was. But there was this thought process that, like, if there was a relationship between the man, he could just, the man and the woman, he could just force himself on her and she would fall in love with him anyway. You know, we saw it, and it's another one that got swept under the rug in my mind. We saw it in the movie Goldfinger when with Pussy Galore, when he goes over and he kisses her, and in theory in that movie, she is a homosexual and he converts her by kissing her, which is just like one of the stupidest things ever if you think about it. But in this one, you know, she's got this aversion to touch, and it you know, it goes to what we have revealed at the end of the movie. But he forces himself on her, and you see, and you know, in a, her own way, it is a little bit of an acting tour de force, because the way her face goes blank and she's just kind of like not living in the moment when it's going on, you know, it sends a big message, I think, as far as the acting goes. But the scene itself is just so unnecessary to the movie, and the funny thing is, from what I've heard, from what, you know, what research I did manage to do, people said, take that scene out, don't do it. And Hitchcock made it clear that was the scene he wanted to do. That was what attracted him to this property. And I think, you know, from purely from a cinematic point of view, I guess, again, I want to get away from the personality, but from a cinematic point of view, I think that's a huge mistake from a guy who didn't make very many cinematic mistakes.
I'm conflicted on it, so I'm not speaking in support of, you know, the act of rape real or implied that the movie showed, but I do think the attempted drowning is like is a crucial part in the transition to coming to understand her trauma. So my only pushback, Paul, is I think you need the drowning scene. So I don't know what you do if you take that out to lead to the drowning scene.
Okay, well, you know, I mean, you could just have him pressuring her emotionally to be physical. True. And not forcing himself on her and having that happen. But even the drowning scene, which, you know, I mean, I don't even want to call it the drowning scene. I want us to call it the attempted suicide, which is really what it is. He pulls her out. He gives her the kiss of life or whatever, and he gets her back. Oh, you know, to being physically okay, and that's kind of like swept under the rug too. It's like, you know, it's a big moment, but it doesn't have the repercussions that I feel it should have.
If anything, his only response is to chastise her for doing such a lousy job by throwing herself into the pool on the ship instead of over the side. Like, he's like, why the pool? If you went over the side, you would have succeeded. Like, and there's no indication here that he's got any remorse. It's like, okay, I did this. And the thing is, it's not an isolated incident, right? He's been through this. He knows that when he forced himself on her, her response was to commit suicide because her life now seems so miserable and inescapable. And yet later in the movie, when they're home, at one point he's leaving her bedroom and explicitly says, "And your door stays open tonight." Like, this is happening again.
Mm. Normally, this is the kind of thing I'm drawn to, and what I mean by that is you've got a typical arc in a movie, right, where you see this and there's kind of like this redemption story, and it's kind of like, okay, we've seen this story before, and I love those kind of stories. So, but I like when usually we'll choose a unique script and choose a unique story to try and do something different with film, right? So this is one of those stories where you kind of expect when these two meet together that this is going to lead to some form of happy ending. I think one of my biggest struggles with this is we go through these deep traumas and all that, and I felt like there was no ending. Like, no ending where I could, like, in my mind imagine where this is going to go productive for these people. Like, what I felt bad for her was she had this childhood trauma that we finally had unfolded in front of us. Mm-hmm. And it was as a child, she came as close as possible to what he actually did to her as an adult. And I'm sitting here like, wait, Mom killed somebody to avoid this, and that put this girl on this path. He actually made that happen to her. And you're right, Trey, the drowning scene, like, I'm with you. Like, that makes sense because of what this poor girl's been through. It's where I went to hating Mark, though. I'm like, boy, Sean Connery's character at that point in time, I'm done with you. I mean, like,
that is the breaking point on him.
But at that point, what I wanted to happen, if anything, to have that trauma that was inflicted on her, make that the moment that brings back the memories that we get at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Make that the moment where she realizes, oh, yes, I, you know, she was the one who actually picked up the poker and finished what her mom started when the guy was going to do this to her.
Mm-hmm.
Have her understand, start the healing process, and do it by saying, I need to leave this relationship. I would have rather seen her clean out all of the family and leave Mark behind.
Yeah. Yes.
Escape with everything he owned after this point, with a better understanding of who she is, so she can move past this trauma.
See, I think two points come up from what you guys were just saying. The first one, when you said about you should have thrown yourself in the ocean. I think that's a poorly developed plot point where he's saying she really didn't want to commit suicide. It was kind of a cry for help, but she wasn't trying to kill herself, because if she was really trying to kill herself, she wouldn't have gone in the pool. I think that, I don't think it's well developed, but I think that's what the message they were trying to send there. And we could agree or disagree on how much it actually conveys that message. The second thing is, the amateur psychology thing, and I am as amateur as you're going to get on psychology, other than taking like two college classes on psychology. But getting her to remember the past trauma, they treat that as if it's the resolution of everything. You know, now that she remembers it, she's okay. Which is just absolutely stupid. Getting her to remember it, if that was really what happened, is the first step of a long journey to make her better.
Mm-hmm.
And rid of Mark is probably the second step.
Yeah, and that's why I would have been okay if it, if she'd made that step at about that 90-minute mark in this 2-hour and 10-minute movie. So you could point, okay, now that we understand the source, we can start to address it and fix it. Understanding the source is not the end point, as you're saying, right? It is just that necessary first of many, many, many steps.
Yeah, of something that may never totally heal.
Mm.
So I can hold it if the rest of you want, because I don't know if you want to jump to the end just yet, but Sean and Blaine, you both had a different read of what happened than I did, so I find that interesting. So, because I didn't think the sailor was on the verge of or was about to molest Marnie the child. It makes sense in terms of part of that being her trauma, and I think the mother thought that's was going to happen, but I didn't think that she was actually in danger of that. At least that was my read of the scene.
I did.
I'll say for sure, I don't know. What it was is that she felt that to the point where she was screaming for her mother. And I could see that going a lot of different paths. I could see the mother's guilt for the fact that she kept exposing her child to this, kind of making the mother snap. I don't know that I'm on the fence with the sailor. As far as he could have just been innocent in that sequence, he also could have been smarmy. I don't know. I don't know. But I'm with you. There's a lot of possibilities. I'm glad you're bringing that up, because there's certain parts of this film that I found like intriguing. And I was actually like, there's the makings here in certain pockets of something that could have been good.
See, I have virtually no doubt watching it, or I had no doubt watching it. I'm not saying your points aren't valid, but I had no doubt in my mind that he intended bad for her. When she showed the discomfort of him showing her attention, he did not back off. He continued to do it. And it didn't feel like an innocent, hey, don't worry, I'm not going to do anything to you. It felt like, I want to keep taking this further and further. And I guess it is subtext, but I felt that, to me, the subtext felt very clear that he envisioned himself doing bad things to her.
Yeah, I think...
Sorry, I was going to say, this is the year that Bruce Dern had two roles, and both of them were about causing trauma for women later in their lives.
So. And Bruce Dern, to me, has, with very, very few exceptions, has always played the creep. So, I automatically put that on him. He's just got this way of speaking that just makes me, it's bone-chilling in its own way.
It is, and I think on a script level, like, if I just had the script with the dialogue, I wouldn't know what that sailor's intentions were. It's possible that, he was one of those guys who fell in love with the prostitute and was trying to bring her away for that life, and winning over the child is one possible approach to doing that. So, like, on a script level, that could have been it. The way he played it, I did not feel that was the goal. I felt just...
You're saying...
his body language, I felt like he said, oh, this is a 2-for-1 deal.
Yeah, that's what I read into it.
Adding another layer to that, whatever his intention was, he was not stopping when
yeah.
he stopped. So even if his, let's go off, he was trying to build a relationship with the child because he was in love with the mother or wanted a continuing relationship with the mother, whatever those motivations are, there still comes a point in time where he should have stopped. And I mean, that's something we all know today a lot more. It's a lot more prevalent today that's those are those lines. Back then, it wouldn't have been as much as it is today. But when you look at that, you're like, oh, I don't care what your motivation was. The girl was screaming. I mean, like, it's done at this point. So you could see the logic of where that story went based on everything that was going on with everybody. That particular portion, I'm like, I kind of get like how this went horribly wrong.
The mother, I guess, you know, we could talk just briefly about her, but I thought her aspect of the story was kind of cool. It's one of the things that I did think was good, was that she, when Marnie goes to see her at the beginning of the movie, she's effectively replaced Marnie with this kid that she's babysitting. It's like, I screwed this up once, and now I'm just giving myself a new start, and I'm just cutting this other one out kind of my life, and I'm going to pretend that didn't happen. And I'm going to do this right. I'm going to be a parental figure to this girl that I babysit, and I'm going to give her a good existence. And that has to go to Marnie's psychological trauma, that she's just been marginalized by her mother, who was really the cause of, you know, in her own way, of the trauma that she suffered in the first place. So it's almost like you have to feel guilty for what I did, is what the mother's telling her.
The mother had no support piece either. Like, it was interesting, like, she went through her own trauma, you know, through this whole thing, and there was nobody to help her pick up the pieces in an era where, quite frankly, it's the mother was trying to survive. I'm not justifying the mother. I want to be very, very clear off of that piece. Mm-hmm. But you see how there was, I don't know where there would have been an arc for the mother to have repaired things with Marnie. Even where the movie ends, I'm like, I don't see that relationship ever getting to the point where there's forgiveness or anything like that. Other than, you know, if Marnie somehow has some path where she becomes okay, and I'm going to put quotes around that, maybe she, you know, it's her mother. So at the end of the day, you know, does she have some form of relationship with her mother because of, you know, she gets some form of balance, but I don't even see that being a thing. But that was the mother was an intriguing arc that I kind of wanted to know more of. And there was nothing like that.
Well, and again, once the trauma comes out, Mark kind of treats the mother with such disdain and disgust. And it's like, man, Mark, you have absolutely like no latitude for commentary here.
Yeah, and he knows most of the story when he gets there, right? He's gone through the court transcript, so he knows that the mother lied about being the one to kill the guy herself and was found not guilty because it was self-defense. So the only thing we knew that we learned was that it was actually Marnie at age 5 who picked up the poker and finished the job.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, I'm reading this going, okay, so if Mark is supposed to be a trained psychologist and he's actually wanting to help her, why would he not warn her about what she's going to hear? Like, he had the court transcripts. It should have been, okay, let's sit down. You read this and see how it's building. And it's such an incredibly unhealthy way for him to have revealed this to Marnie and had her learn it.
It's not healing.
No, it was a trained psychologist actually using what he knew for evil. Because really, in the way he revealed it, what he did is destroyed a relationship between a mother and daughter and left Marnie with really the best option in her, based on the situation she was in at that time, was to go with sort of the known quantity in Mark. Because she, like at the end, she's like, I don't know if reluctantly is the right word. It was just weird the way that she kind of rolled out that, like, now she finally wants to go with him, sort of. And I wasn't like buying into, like, oh, that's great. Now they're going to go off together. I'm just like, this guy's worse than mom. And yet he's trying to paint this picture of mom being the monster in this one. Like, the unfortunate circumstance when you look at the flashback was, it's a mother who is trying to protect her daughter from a situation she may have read correctly or misread. Doesn't matter. It's her daughter was screaming. Then her daughter ended up finishing the job, you know, in that particular scenario. And the mother took the heat for it because she was trying to protect her child. And I'm like sitting here like, all right, in the end of this, mom's okay in my book. I mean, I'm sorry ish, you know, in comparison to Mark. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, you're looking at a room of three there, right? It's like, who do I want Marnie staying with? Mark or mom? I'm like, I'd rather her stay with mom and, like, let's work this out.
I think Blaine led us to the thought that the most satisfying ending would be if she packed her bags and said, I'm starting a new life with neither of you.
And stole everything of Mark's. Like, I would have much rather the ending of this story than, hey, life as a thief is great. If I take all of this stuff from Mark right now, I rip him off, and I'm going somewhere, like, I'm in the Caribbean.
Yeah, like I wouldn't want her retiring in the Caribbean. Yeah. I would want, like, if they took this 2-hour, 10-minute movie, turned into a 3-hour movie, I'd want those last 50 minutes with her saying, okay, this is how I got here. This is my plan going forward. I'm going to clean Mark out and then systematically clean out every other man like Mark who's doing this to women.
Yes.
Or like a Robin Hood. Let me target scumbags and wipe them out.
If this movie ended with her somehow bankrupting Mark, having all her money, and leaving to find the next guy, you know, and you could work that all into the story, that would be a far more satisfying ending.
Yes,
you know, present him as the villain that he is.
There's now a version of this film that ends with them going back to the house, her acting, you know, kind of still recovering from the trauma. They're in the bedroom. He leaves, closes the door. She acts like she's getting changed or something, but walks over to the safe, and this time has absolutely no problem taking all the money out and putting it in her purse, looks to the camera, winks, roll credit.
Yeah. I think that's far more satisfying ultimately.
Then she's the hero of the story.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't do, you know, it's like they did a half-assed job of redeeming Mark, or making his actions seem justified, not showing just how detestable his behavior was, and making it almost seem like, yes, see, he saved her, which is not the ending we should have gotten.
Yeah, I don't get the redemption there. I get the, now I've removed every other support structure you have. I am all that you have left.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's, but I think, I don't think that's the message the movie's trying to give us. I think that's the message that's there, but I don't think that's what they're trying to. I think that's where the script fails us.
Yeah.
Area that the script failed, I don't know why, but it stood out to me. It's not that big a point, but it just seemed like such a shortcut script-wise, is to show how her prior boss was so infatuated with her by him just, you know, giving off a litany of description of her to the point where it's like, oh, you know, this guy's obsessed. But it seemed like just a little over the top. It almost seemed comedic that it was presented that way. And I thought that was a little, you know, like I said, it came off as a little comedic. It didn't make me feel like, oh, see, she's, you know, she's a siren that, you know, that overwhelmed him somehow emotionally. It almost felt like this should have been a comedy at that point, that they could have led to, you know, a Dirty Rotten Scoundrels type script. But it did not. Is there anyone else in the cast that you think is worth mentioning?
We did have a gentleman who came out of the hotel room at about a 5-minute mark.
Where's Alfred?
Yeah. And honestly, it's, after this movie, it's tough to call him a gentleman, but yeah.
Yeah, that was, I mean, that one, he didn't try and hide it in the slightest. And I think that got to the point of, you know, that was the, I don't want people looking for me. I want to make it very clear. Here I was, goodbye. You know, I'm going to do it very early in the movie, and I'm not going to even, you know, make any attempt to be subtle. I think he looks at the camera. It's almost like breaking the fourth wall.
Yeah, and he looks with a, you know, because Marnie has walked past him down the hallway. He looks at her and then turns to the camera like, who, did you see her?
Yeah.
One of the things I did like about the film, and we didn't get a chance to talk about it, that I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, I did like that she'd done this multiple times. And we as a viewer were kind of learning just how much it was done, as kind of Mark was. So I liked that journey, and I was really intrigued. There was like things in this that I'm like, oh, I wish we just spent more on that and headed more in that direction with her. Because when they're at the track, and all of a sudden she's being recognized. I liked those beats where there was something to cover up, you know, that this life that she had chosen, this way that she had chosen to maybe escape her trauma, or these other personas that she was crafting, there was something too, like there's a danger to that, and that can come back to haunt you. And, you know, you're a very beautiful woman, and yes, changing your hair color and all that, and kind of giving yourself these different sort of personas is going to last a certain amount of time. But if you're intersecting with people who knew you, different hair color is not going to hide the fact that, hey, that's that girl. And I know that's the one that took, you know, some major money from us. I mean, there's at least recognition, and you can't let go of that recognition. It's a very real thing. And I actually was enjoying those beats, and it was all of a sudden like, now we're like covering all this up, pushing it all away, and heading down this very dark path. It was like almost there was points in times where I felt like it was two different movies that I was watching, and I was liking certain elements of the suspense being built with her thievery that I kind of wanted more of.
It felt to me like that the purpose of that scene was not what you described, which is what it should have been.
Yes, yes.
To bring up the suspense, and hey, is her past life going to catch up with her? And I think that would have been a good way to go. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the way we would have liked it to go. And that's what we were seeing there. But I don't think it went there. I don't think it was even intended to go there. I think it was intended to show how Mark was compartmentalizing her life, and that he would shield her from this stuff because he owned her at this point.
But there were nuggets there of intrigue, or I was like sitting here like, oh my gosh, there's something here you could do.
they could have, but they didn't, because once he leaves, that's it. We never get any more of it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I wanted to bring it up, just because I'm like, these were really good scenes that like got me excited. And
you know, I think it would have also been better if they had taken some of Lil's selfish motivation away, and maybe if they had the theme that the women in the film are more likely to be on to her.
Yeah.
'Cause, you know, Paul had asked about, you know, other performances. You know, we had Mariette Hartley as Mark's secretary, who Marnie works with, and I kind of got that undercurrent of friendship, but also that Susan kind of picked up a vibe that something was going on. So I kind of would have liked the undercurrent of she's able to play men, but other women are kind of more intuitively onto her, so to speak. Again, this would have been so much better as a heist film.
I think Hitchcock's intention, what he was trying to do, was the amateur psychology aspect. And I don't think that was, you know, it wasn't deeply enough delved into. It wasn't, I think what he really would have needed was to have some sort of a consultant on this film who is a psychologist or a psychiatrist to say, this is how it works. And this is, you know, the way the healing process is. And this is the way the revelation process is. And then you kind of build your script around that a little bit. But I don't think they did that. I think they just went with the amateur. Okay, yeah, we're going to, you know, she has repressed memories, and we're going to bring them out, and that's how we're going to fix this movie. And it's stupid.
But a psychologist that could tell him this is when it gets immoral.
That too. You know, just by way of noting, young Marnie in the flashback scene was played by Melody Thomas Scott, who went on to many, many years. I think for all I know, she's still on Young and the Restless, which is just kind of interesting that that's where her career has gone. Who else was of note? We had Mariette Hartley as a co-worker, and you know, she became famous. She was in one episode of Star Trek where she fell in love with Spock, and she also was doing Polaroid commercials with James Garner for a long time. And who else do we have here that's of note? I think we could mention Diane Baker as Lily, Mark's former sister-in-law, because I do think that's another dynamic that just seems strange. You know, she's clearly in love with him, and I think she clearly thinks that, you know, that now that her sister's gone, he's going to fall in love with her and she's going to marry him. If I picked up the backstory correctly, it was almost like, you know, because she's younger, that they effectively kind of had her living with them and they were raising her when his wife was still alive. So it's not a healthy infatuation that she has, but it also, I'm trying to remember, like something in like medieval times, like if the wife died, the sister would automatically like marry the husband. It almost feels like that kind of thing, which is weird. But you know, she clearly sees through what's going on, and you know, that goes to Trey's point. You know, so I think there are a lot of elements here story wise that could have been much more interesting or much more well developed than they were, and that's one of the ones that I feel like kind of fell flatter than it should have.
To the point of shouting out the acting, the little girl who was the mother was replacing Marnie with, she played a brilliant role. Just in the sense that she played the quote unquote sweet manipulator, I thought in a really strong way, because she was like, Marnie had her head on the mother's leg and the mother was, you know, kind of pushing her away. But then the girl went and sat on the leg to get her hair brushed. And was looking at Marnie when she was doing it. And I thought just played a very... none of that seemed contrived. It seemed like she was really embracing the role. And there were moments of acting in this that I thought were just like really brilliantly done in a movie that like just fell apart.
You know, Hitchcock famously did not like working with children. And I suspect that he gave them very, very strict directions and said, this is what you're doing and that's it. And I don't think he put up with any, you know, silliness or trying to make these children happy. So I think they were brought in, did their scene and gone. And when they could do a job like that, I think, you know, it speaks very well for their ability to act.
Yeah.
So, you know, just moving on, I think it's worth mentioning this is the last of several films that Bernard Herrmann scored for Hitchcock. I think of the ones where I've been aware of the score you know, just kind of like taking note of it, this is probably the weakest because it felt very by the numbers to me. It didn't really feel like it was setting a tone, and it didn't feel like it was bringing me more into any scenes that went by. And I think Bernard Herrmann was, you know, a brilliant scorer, conductor, composer. But I don't think this film shows his best work.
No, it's... I almost wonder... because this is not just his last collaboration with cinematographer Robert Burks and with editor George Tomancini.
Mm-hmm. And Burks, as I said earlier, I think did a brilliant job in this movie. I think the cinematography is really, really good. But to be fair, when I looked back at the other Hitchcock movies he worked on, I think it's brilliant in all of them.
Yeah. So, but when you lose editor George Tomasini, composer Bernard Herrmann, cinematographer Robert Burks, all at the same time when they all still had active careers, I'm wondering if part of the reason the score doesn't resonate with us is because the script didn't resonate with Herrmann. like how many of these guys were looking at what was going on both on the screen and with what Hitchcock was doing with Tippi Hedren and the way he was treating her. How many of them stopped collaborating with him because they were saying, no, I'm done with you at this point?
Yeah, very possible.
I mean, yeah, Bernard Herrmann. Well, Trey and I bring his name up often in our Best Picture podcast because he is frequently and deservedly nominated for his work. Like, he is one of the greats. You roll the clock back a few decades and, you know, John Williams is his closest successor, where he's delivering solid scores pretty much all the time. Here, I didn't feel it. And that's so I wonder how much of it is just maybe Herrmann wasn't feeling the script and he's just, okay, let's just get her done because I signed the contract.
Yeah, very, very possible. Anyone have any other thoughts before we get to the final question? All right, then we are there. You know, it's interesting to know that the reception of this movie critically was weak when the movie came out. And somehow it's been changed over the years where this is looked at much, much more favorably by the critical masses. And I'm not sure exactly why. As I said, I think the acting is brilliant. I think the directing is very, very solid. I think the cinematography is gorgeous. But the story fails it. And I think the story fails it on levels that we hit on. It's not just, okay, there's one thing that they fail to develop. There are many things they fail to develop. And they take a lot of shortcuts on the resolution. So the script brings the whole movie down, as far as I'm concerned. It isn't a bad film. It isn't a Jaws 4. But it's not one that I have any desire to see again, based on all the superlatives that it does have. That really speaks for how the script is failing it. So I'm going to say it's a Jaws 3.
I'm going to say this one's a Jaws 4 for me. And I have trouble saying that because I think if you're a Hitchcock fan or Hitchcock historian, which I'm a Hitchcock fan, so I'm glad I saw it. So I do want to say that, and I would say maybe it's a Jaws 3 for you if you're a Hitchcock fan because of the fact that you should see it. So I would recommend it from that standpoint. I think where it's a Jaws 4 for me is, I'll go to the pivotal point. When the horse sequence happens, and it's not because it was a horse sequence, it was the point where the film had done too much to me. And I don't mind being a punching bag during a movie, but I want the story to be worth it, worth that journey. It was after that that it was like punching bag moment after punching bag moment, and there was no story payoff to that. And there's a lot of different ways story can pay that off. I don't mind a nebulous ending or an unhappy ending when I feel like the journey was worth that kind of, I'm left to, in my own head, figure out where I think these characters might go. I just felt like at the end, I'm like, I don't know that I even really know who they are by the end of this. And that's where it kind of fell apart for me. I'm glad we did this. I love talking about it. I would watch it again for the purpose of if I was doing it on a podcast or to sit down if we were to say, hey, as a group, let's get together and have dinner and talk about this film. I would do it for that reason only. Other than that, I have no interest in seeing this again. And that's why it's a Jaws 4 for me. I would only recommend it to somebody who is intrigued from a film history standpoint to watch this. That's me.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a Jaws 3. I'm with Paul. You take away the script, the performances, and, you know, so the film craft on display was of a higher quality than what the script delivered. And it didn't bore me. That being said, I'm equally with Paul and, you know, Sean. You know, even if we were to have that conversation, Sean, I'm more likely to use Wikipedia to prompt my memory than to really feel the need to go back and watch it again. So I'm going to give it a Jaws 3.
And this one, I was going back and forth between Jaws 3 and 4 while I was thinking about it, because, as we said, the flaws are really on the script level.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you really can make a better movie starting from this script. But the script level is huge, right? A bad director can make a bad movie starting with a good script.
Yeah.
But what we have here is concrete proof that one of the best directors in human history cannot turn a bad script into a good movie.
Yeah.
If the script is weak, so is the finished product, period. And this is... it's not just that the script fails. It's that the fact that they take someone who explicitly commits marital rape once and implicitly does it a second time in a way that implies it's not just these two instances, and then presents setting up a future where the rapist and his victim are together forever as the happy ending, I find this just downright offensive. So to me, this is a Jaws 4. And I have seen most of Hitchcock's filmography at this point. There's only two Hitchcock films that I would rate as a Jaws 4. And both of them suffer at the script level, but this is the only one that just outright offends me with the messages it is sending. I mean, true, it's 1964. The U.S. didn't recognize marital rape as a crime anywhere until 1975. It took till 1990 something before, I think 93, before it's recognized everywhere. Here in Canada, it was 83. But Russia had the marital rape laws in 1920. Poland had them in 1922. Right. There's some countries that still say, no, if it's within marriage, it cannot be rape. There's some that say it's only rape if violence is involved. But to this, that elephant in the room is too big for me to get past. And for me, this is Jaws 4.
Well, and I don't want to dogpile on Hitchcock, but you're right, Blaine. You know, you made the statement, a bad director can ruin a good script, but in this case, even a great director couldn't salvage a bad script. This is a bad script that, while Hitchcock didn't write it, he had complete control over. So he chose the novel to adapt. He was hiring the screenwriters. He was firing them when they weren't lining up with his vision. So I agree with everything that you said, and Hitchcock has a lot of culpability in this instance for the script being bad.
Yeah, I agree with that. And we're just listening to what you guys say, I'm sticking with my Jaws 3, but I definitely understand the Jaws 4.
Mm-hmm.
So that said, that's it for Marnie. We could sweep Marnie under the rug now. and we were talking before we started to record, and we picked what our next Hitchcock movie will be, whenever that will be. And Blaine, why don't you give that to everyone?
So the one that the three of us discussed before the fourth one joined the call is Spellbound.
Cool.
So anybody who's, you know, interested in watching along with us between now and when that episode comes up, seek out Spellbound. I'm not sure exactly where it's streaming, but I'm confident it is.
Yeah, I've got the Criterion Collection edition. So we're looking at something that was released on Halloween 1945. I'm going to pull up Just Watch to see what it lists for places to watch it. Doing. Okay, well, you do yours because mine's tied to my account, so I can give the Canadian answers. You might have different answers in the U.S.
Spellbound, 1945. It's not streaming anywhere, according to Just Watch.
Yeah, nor in Canada either. So
you may have to do a little searching. Well, we may all have to do a little searching to find this one, because I don't think I have the DVD at the moment, but my library usually has a pretty good collection of videos for me to watch. So I'm sure I will be able to find it, and we'll be able to have this conversation.
Yeah, it has had multiple releases, so...
In the meanwhile, I'm just going to thank everybody for coming on. I'm going to thank everybody for listening. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
It was horrible. It was horrible.
Tippi Hedren is finally opening up about the abuse she says she suffered at the hands of Alfred Hitchcock, the legendary director who made her a star and then ruined her career because she refused to sleep with him.
It is the worst thing to be the object of someone's obsession if you're not interested. It became unbearable.
Tippi was a struggling single mom when Hitchcock plucked her from obscurity to star in his blockbuster horror classic, The Birds. By the way, that little girl was daughter Melanie Griffith. Tippi writes about Hitchcock's obsession with her in her new autobiography, Tippi, A Memoir, on sale now. He suddenly grabbed me and put his hands on me. It was sexual, it was perverse, and it was ugly. The harder I fought him, the more aggressive he became.
How serious was it? Did Alfred Hitchcock try to have sex with you?
Well, he never got that far. I stopped it immediately.
Hitchcock retaliated, she says, with pure cruelty. He replaced mechanical birds with real ones in that famous attack scene from The Birds. That's not fake blood. She really was pecked in the face by the birds.
He told me he'd ruined my career. I said, do what you have to do. I don't care. I'm out.
Tippi's legacy lives on in daughter Melanie, and of course, for a new generation, granddaughter Dakota Johnson, the star of the steamy movie 50 Shades of Grey. Too much for this grandma.
Have you seen it?
No.